Hello, this is Larry Goins. Welcome to the bi-weekly Q&A Inner Circle Calls. How is everybody doing?
Excellent.
What's happening?
Hello.
Making offers.
Well,
yeah.
That's the three most important things in real estate. That's good. So if it's your first time joining us, we got a lot of people on here today. Some people like to sit back and listen. Some people have questions. Sometimes I have to beg people, come on, give me a question. Sometimes there's question after question, and we're on here for a couple hours. So it just really depends on you guys. I'll be here as long as you need me. And so that's why we're here. So with that, let's just jump right in. And who has a question you'd like to jump in with first?
Well, I've got a question. This is Gary in Asheville.
Go ahead.
Okay, something that came up for me tonight, I had this, tonight's our main meeting of our area group here in Asheville. And pardon?
It's tonight.
Yes, it is tonight, yes. I just saw James down there a little while ago. So I had to leave early to get here for the phone call because the phone call was more important. And I always show up early so I can network with everybody as much as possible before. But something came up in a conversation with somebody who is a private lender about Dodd-Frank. And we agreed that we can only do three personal deals. That's okay. And, of course, the remainder need to be done with an RMLO. But she said that if you were financing your own property, that you couldn't do it as an LLC. You had to do it personally. Do you know anything about that?
Well, when you mentioned you were talking to your private lender and they said that you couldn't do any more than three deals, are you talking about they could not loan you money on more than three deals without using
No, that I couldn't be the seller. I couldn't do seller financing on more than three deals. And if I did, I had to do it personally and not under the umbrella of my LLC.
Okay, well, first of all, Dodd-Frank only applies if you are selling a house with owner financing and you do not live in that house, but you're selling it with owner financing to someone who is going to live in the house.
Right.
So if you're selling the house, if you're selling the house to an investor, or if like a private money lender is loaning you money on a property, then Dodd-Frank does not apply at all.
Okay.
And you can do up to three, in an LLC or individually or whatever, up to three without using an RMLO. After the three, it doesn't make any difference if you are the seller personally or it's a trust or it's an LLC or it's a corporation or whatever, you must use an RMLO to originate that loan.
Absolutely. I knew that.
Larry, this is Meg. I heard from my RMLO that if I was originating a loan in my LLC, that I couldn't actually do it without an RMLO, and I think that's what this guy's talking about.
Well, you're saying you couldn't do one without an RMLO?
You could not do seller financing out of a company without an RMLO. You could do it personally if you are the personal owner.
Let me just say this. I have done so much research on it. I probably know more about it than Dodd or Frank. And I've gone to many events about seller financing. I taught a seller financing event. I've had RMLOs come in and speak, and that's one I've never heard.
Okay.
Now, I could be wrong. I'm not perfect.
And so could my RMLO.
That's one I've never heard. I've never heard anybody say you can't do any from your LLC without going through an RMLO. And I don't know, maybe that's them trying to get you on the first three in addition
what
to
she
one
said,
after that.
What she said was you couldn't do, even with an RMLO, you couldn't do it through your LLC. You had to do it personally, not through your LLC.
I can tell you beyond a shadow of a doubt that's absolutely not true.
Perfect. That's what I thought, too. Okay, thank you.
You're very welcome. Who else has a question?
While we're talking about RMLOs, can I ask something?
Oh, sure. Go ahead. Jump in, Meg.
I theoretically have a closing tomorrow, and my RMLO has not sent me anything at all in terms of his papers as a result of his underwriting,
uh-huh.
It just feels to me that that's not right. Now, he says he's protecting the consumer's private information, but I just feel like I'm not prepared to go to the closing and close the deal because I have no idea what the underwriting process has been.
Have you give them any underwriting guidelines?
I did.
Okay. Have they underwritten the deal to not only show you that it's 43% debt ratio or less, but also that they have a good rental history or a good car payment history, or have they done their VOE, verification of employment?
That's what I'm saying, Larry. I don't know what they've done because they haven't sent me anything.
Okay. Well, what I would just do is I would say, as the lender, unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to approve this loan because you haven't given me any of the information that you've taken. So as of right now, nobody's closing the deal and nobody's getting paid.
So they should be able to share something.
I am the lender. Well, they should be able to share all of it because you are the one extending credit.
Mm-hmm.
There's no reason in the world, and Meg, I feel your pain because I've had to do this with two or three different lenders in the past, and two or three different RMLOs, and they're saying I can't share that information, it's private, you know, and I have to go back and say, if you are a broker and you're originating a loan for a lender, does the lender get that information? Well, yes. Well, I'm the lender in this case.
Mm-hmm.
So, and if they don't want to share it, just tell them. I mean, here's what I did with one of them. I ended up copying everybody I knew in the company. And I said, I want this information within 24 hours or we're not going any further. I can't do any more deals. If I can't originate and know how to contact these people, if I don't know for sure, I have to be able to know because I'm the lender. I'm the one extending credit, not you. All I'm using you for is to comply with Dodd-Frank. You're not doing anything. So I had to send an email, and I copied about 12 people on it from the CEO, president, operations, CFO, COO, and everybody. And I got what I needed.
Okay.
So that's what I would do. Do you mind me asking who is your RMLO?
So this is the first deal with these folks. It's the Carolina Choice Mortgage. And I got that recommendation from Nathan. And, of course, he said it wasn't really a recommendation because he had just started working with them, too. But it was because somebody else that we'd been had in mind had pulled their license out of North Carolina. So we were all scrambling.
Yeah, you're talking about Texas Pride, but now you're working with United Home Loan, which is Carolina Choice.
Yeah.
They should give you that. They should give you that. We've done the same thing with them that we've had to do with everybody else. But you're the one extending credit. So you should get that. No different than any lender they would send a deal to as a broker.
Awesome.
Yeah, good. Cool. And who else was about to jump in?
Yeah, it's Dave McGee.
What's going on?
Hey, how you doing?
Congratulations on your two deals since you left the office a few weeks ago.
Well, thanks. We're still looking for more.
Well, I would hope so.
I don't know. Is Forrest on the line?
Forrest, are you on the line?
Yeah, I'm here.
What's up?
What's up? Well, getting to Carolina Choice Mortgage and Carolina Choice Mortgage United Home Loan Service, they service these loans, right?
They service in South Carolina and I believe Virginia too and Georgia and soon to be North Carolina and Tennessee. And they also, I know they service now in Florida.
So some of the people that are on there, are they in trouble with Carolina?
No, she was just talking about that they were reluctant to give her underwriting information. But what you have to do is you have to talk to Billy. Talk to Billy Howard. He's the owner.
Yeah. I talked to him while I was down in your office. But
yeah, I remember that.
And he was kind of in a hurry to get me off and move on to something else. But
he's always in a hurry. He's very busy. But the sad thing is these RMLOs are few and far between that understand this. And so we're almost at their mercy right now, you know? That's the sad thing. We're kind of at their mercy right now.
So what's his turnaround time then? Because
we've got it down to 2 weeks so far. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to get it down to about 2.5 weeks, something like that. I'm trying to get it down to 9 days, but we've got it down to about 2.5 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So. But, you know, what we've tried to do now is we try to gather all the information. Like, I'm going to get the pay stubs, the W-2s, the tax returns, and a copy of the driver's license and Social Security card, and I'm going to scan it and send all that over to them and then say, all I need you to do is call them and get an app, pull credit, put everything in your system, and do whatever you need to do to comply, you know, with your banking commission. And then just let me know when I can close it.
Now, one of the things I noticed, Larry, you didn't, and you probably couldn't, but because you had different servicing programs or servicing companies out there, but there's no credit application or anything, you know, in your thumb drive and your flash drive.
A credit application for the borrowers?
Yeah.
That's because you're not allowed to take it.
Oh. Okay.
Now, all you need to do, if you want to do like your first three without an RMLO, just Google 1003 and with the keyword .pdf, and you'll find a 1003 out there online. And if I'm not mistaken, on the thumb drive is a 1003 credit app. But you can double check and look, but if not, just Google 1003, and that's the standard Fannie Mae credit application that every mortgage company in the United States uses.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, then if we're not allowed to get this information, I mean, are we allowed to get their pay stubs, their W-2s, their taxes?
I can't find anything in the Dodd-Frank statute that says I can't. It just says I'm not allowed to take the application. So I have told my RMLO that's what I'm going to do unless they can show me in the general statute where it says I can't.
Uh-huh.
And I do that to try to speed up the process.
Right. Well, that was what I was wondering. Okay.
Yeah.
Because my son and I have kind of split the duties up. He's finding the properties, making offers, and I'm working the back end of it with the new buyers.
Well, from what it sounds like, You're out there getting deals at the Bojangles, too.
That took a little courage to do that. But, you know, I found out that I've been talking to people, and people are interested in finder's fee. And we offer a finder's fee. And it's probably too much, maybe. But I offer $1,000 for anybody who brings me a deal. And my way of thinking about it is we would have to spend thousands and thousands of dollars market researching and sending out letters and making calls, taking time to make calls at dead ends and everything. So I thought $1,000, why not? I know people offer $500, but that really gets people's attention, $1,000.
It does.
And I have a lot of people go, wow, I'll save that card. Yeah, I'm really interested in that. So
there you go. Does your card have $1,000 bird dog fee on the back of it?
Yes, it does.
That's great.
Referral fee. $1,000 referral fee.
Referral fee. That's good.
Right.
Well, good for you.
Yep.
That's great.
Thank you.
Awesome. Did you have another question, or was that it?
Well, that's it for me. Thank you.
Oh.
I'll probably think of something else here.
No problem. If you do, just jump in.
Yeah.
Who's next?
Hey, Larry. This is Patty in Asheville, North Carolina.
What's happening, Patty? How are you?
Hey, we're getting a storm coming in, so I'm going to try to get a couple of double-wide questions out. Most double-wides are on frames. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And that's not necessarily a bad thing.
No, that's just the way it is.
Okay.
Yeah, that's kind of the way they're built.
Okay. So, and with double wides that are on a permanent foundation versus ones that have a skirt, are ones that have a skirt considered real estate or personal property?
Very good question. That really has nothing to do with it. What it has to do with it is, has the title been surrendered at the DMV, and is it now taxed as real property as opposed to personal property?
Okay. And how do you find that out?
You have to ask your seller, and it will be revealed in the title search as well.
Okay. So that will be revealed in the title.
And your attorney can handle that for you. Like I have one right now that I bought recently where we bought it from a bank and not HUD. If you're buying it from HUD, you can rest assured that the title's been surrendered. I've never bought a house from HUD that had a title to the mobile home. It was all had been surrendered and titled as real estate. However, I bought one from a bank recently that during the title search it showed up, and the attorney said, just wanted to let you know this. It's not a big deal. I'll take care of it. By the time you get it sold, I'll have it taken care of. And so, you know, just know that it does need to be done, but they can take care of it for you.
Yeah, so this one, the one I'm looking at is a Fannie Mae.
Uh-huh.
So I should just deal with that during the title search process.
Are you buying it through Hubzu?
No, it's a direct bid to Fannie Mae.
Okay. Have you seen the offer to purchase yet?
Yes.
Okay. Did it have anything in there about seasoning? In other words, you had to keep the property. You could not sell the property within 90 days and make over X percentage.
Well, they haven't. I'm just getting the offer in, so they haven't come back and put that in yet.
Okay. Well, just be on the lookout for that, because Fannie Mae properties, it's typically in there.
Right. And I knew that, but a remedy for that would be to find a buyer and let them rent for a couple months, right?
Or, now you could do this, and you're in Asheville, right?
Right.
I'm
investing in South Carolina.
Okay, it's in South Carolina?
Right.
Okay, South Carolina land contracts, if you're using a land contract, does not need to be recorded.
Okay.
So technically you are selling it, but there's nobody going to see that that you sold it on a land contract because it's not recorded, as South Carolina doesn't require it. So, you know, technically you sold it, but nothing's ever recorded, so nobody knows you sold it.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Okay. And attorneys are okay with that?
You would need to ask your attorney, whoever you're going to get to close it,
I would
ask them what they say.
Okay.
You could sell it on a lease option, or shouldn't I sell it? You could lease option it for six months if you wanted to, and just say, look, we need to make sure you're going to have a good pay history. And if you have a good pay history, then we'll convert you to a land contract.
Okay. And another question, when you get your contractor out there, of course, to look over things, or when you're in your due diligence period, with mobiles like double wides on land, some of them have public water, some of them have wells, but most of them have septics. Would you get a septic inspection?
You know what? That's a great question, but I never have.
Okay, you never have?
I never have done it, no.
Okay.
I guess I've been fortunate, but I've never done it.
All right. Well, and I guess that's the thing. I think that sometimes it's hard to find where the septic is. But I guess if you had someone come out and you were getting, or if the owner wanted the septic drained or whatever, that septic people know where to find them?
Yeah, usually whenever there's a permit, there's a diagram that's given to the building inspection department that lets them know where you're planning on putting it, so they know that the drain fill lines are in the right place, the drain fill lines are long enough, and the property has to have what's called a perk test so that the water settles enough to where it can handle the amount of drainage or sewage from a one-bedroom, two-bedroom, three-bedroom, four-bedroom, whatever.
Okay.
Yeah. And the property has to be what's called perk tested, where they go out, they determine the amount of water that the soil will absorb. And based on that, they determine whether or not the size of the lot and how many bedrooms you can put, you know, how many bedroom of a house you can put on there, whether it's a mobile home or a site-built house.
Okay, good.
Good. Does that help?
Yeah, definitely.
Great.
Definitely.
Who else has a question?
Hey, Larry.
Hey, Larry, this is Caitlin.
Hey.
Hey, Patty's real estate partner. When you've got a contract on a house from what we think is a wholesaler, and they sign their name, and doing your due diligence, you find that they don't really own the home, someone else does. Can you ask that person for their contract to ensure that they have the right to sell that house from the person who's on the deed?
You could, but if they're buying it from an individual, they should have just assigned it to you.
Mm.
In other words, you should have just assigned an assignment agreement. And they're assigning that original contract that they have with the seller, and then they would give you a copy of that because they don't really have, you know, unless they give you a copy of that, they don't really have anything to assign.
Right. They didn't, though. They gave us a real estate contract.
A new contract.
Yes.
When is there anywhere that it says owner and there's that name in there, or they put their name in there?
Right.
They put their name in there. Well, you could just say, you know, our attorney has let us know, or in doing a title search, it doesn't appear that you own this property.
Mm.
You know, what's going on here? Now I'm a little nervous. Now I'm a little nervous
because
you're trying to sell me a house you don't own. So what's going on?
Right. Which is all the more reason to do your due diligence.
Right. Exactly.
Cool, thanks.
You're very welcome. Go ahead, Forrest.
Yeah, Larry, on that septic issue that she was just talking about, do you typically have the septic pump for a new owner?
No.
Or is that something just let it go?
Never done that before.
Okay.
Yep, never even had it come up.
All right. So I need that. Thank you.
Cool. No problem at all. Who's next?
Hey, Larry. This is Fred from Wilmington.
Fred, what's up?
It's all good. It's all good, man.
Awesome.
Hey, just you know, the past couple of houses I looked at and have offers in on are having a contract. You know, I just want to get your feedback on how much you will actually put into a house, you know, just to make it more marketable. For instance, the past two houses I've looked at, the offer price was perfect, but they all need to have the carpets torn out. I mean, I wouldn't move them to them with the existing flooring. And so I'm wondering how much do you look at that and how do you gauge what you're willing, additional work you're willing to do on the house before you put it on the market?
Well, personally, I don't want to have to do anything.
Uh-huh.
Okay? And I don't mean personally like me go out there and install the carpet. I just mean
my way of thinking
is I don't want to have to do any repairs. Okay. Now, having said that, you know, if we get a house that maybe it needs paint and carpet, or whatever it needs, then we're going to try to sell it as is until it comes time to close on it. Now, what's it, and this is kind of deviating a little bit from your question, but I'm going to get back to it. But if we're marketing that property, if we're getting a lot of calls, if we're getting people go out there and look at it, if we have a lot of people that say, oh, I like the area, I like the neighborhood, but it needs carpet. I don't, you know, I don't want to buy something where I got to do a lot of work. It needs carpet, or it needs countertop, or it needs this. We keep notes in our CRM, Podio. If we get, you know, a lot of people, and I shouldn't say a lot. If we get, you know, five or more people or something, and I don't have a specific number, but if we get a reasonable number of people that are saying, oh, no carpet, no carpet, no carpet, no carpet, but nobody's saying bad neighborhood, or it's out in the middle of nowhere, out in the middle of nowhere, or whatever. If there's something that we can fix, but we're getting a lot of traction on it, then we'll, at that point, once we buy it, we'll do those repairs. But if they're saying bad neighborhood, we just won't close on it, if that makes sense.
Right.
So we try to sell it as is first, and if we can't do that, then we try to sell it. Then we try to sell it or after we fix it up.
Okay, as a follow-up, do you ever attempt to sell it as is and then negotiate with a potential buyer to replace the carpet or to, you know, do some painting?
Exactly.
So in other words, if I have a buyer on the hook and you know, they're saying, you know what, I really like to say, well, yeah, okay, well, I'll give you an allowance for that, or I will, you know, add that in and then mark up the price by a couple thousand dollars to cover that cost.
Right. Well, basically, yes, we do. But we tell them what's it cost to put paint and carpet in the double wide? You know, probably less than $5,000, $4,000 maybe, okay?
Right.
We're probably going to tell them it's $10,000. And then, you know, $10,000, I can get it done a lot cheaper than that. Well, that's exactly why we're trying to help you out, so you can pick your own colors, pick your own installer, install it yourself, and save a lot of money. Because we're 2 hours away or 5 hours away, and we've got to hire licensed, bonded, insured contractors, and they have to go out there and do it, and we have to pay their markup. So, unfortunately, we cannot get it done for $4,000. And that's the reason we're offering you a discount. Now, we're offering you the house for $69.9, but if we put the carpet in it, it's going to be $79.9.
Got it. And it's probably not going to do much to their payment anyway. $10,000 on your notes.
No. What's a payment difference on $10,000 spread over 10 to 20 years?
Right.
Good.
Yep. Okay.
Awesome. Does that help, Fred?
Sure does.
Excellent. Good. Cool. So who else has a question?
Larry, this is Gary in Asheville again. Nobody else is going to speak up, I'll be happy to speak.
Okay.
As clarification on something you said earlier, did you say Carolina Choice Mortgage is not doing RMLOs in North Carolina yet?
No, we were talking about servicing.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
Great.
Servicing.
Good. Okay.
Yes, they do. They are an RMLO in North Carolina, South Carolina,
yeah.
Georgia,
okay.
And Florida, and soon to be Tennessee, and they are a servicer in South Carolina, Florida, Georgia, and Virginia, and soon to be Tennessee and North Carolina.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. Great. Wonderful. And my question it's a question. Sometimes when I'm going through my leads and trying to find properties, I get this sense that I'm working too hard to find properties, and that I have to really dig for them to find the properties. And then when I dig for them, I immediately want to know as much about them as I can to find out if I do really want to make an offer on them. So I do a lot of research before I go too far. But what I come across a lot is properties are either the listed price is not really a listed price at all. It's a beginning bid because it's an auction, or it's a time limit bid.
Right.
Or they have multiple, they just say straight up they have multiple offers. I just bypass those.
Good for you. Me too.
Okay, good. I just wondered if that was smart to do. I mean, I just don't even want to bother with those. I'm not going to get into a bidding war with other investors.
Unless you're specifically working auction properties like auction.com or homesale.com.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like to me like you're looking like on Zillow, and you see instead of it saying foreclosure or for sale by owner, or realtor or listed property, sometimes it says auction. I just bypass all those.
Yeah, and I'm working a lot out of the MLS.
Good.
So I have MLS access. That's primarily where I'm working right now, and I've gone into a couple of auctions, but I've only done two of them. But my experience has been when I've been on those that there's a bunch of unknowledgeable buyers out there trying to buy those to live in, which is probably fine.
Right.
But they don't know how to. They're not bidding from an investor's perspective, and so I'm seeing a lot of these two homes that I really watched closely. I knew what they were worth, and I saw them go for like $10,000 or $20,000 more than what they were worth.
And
at least to me,
auction.
So.
They just automatically think auction equals good deal, and that's
mm-hmm.
not necessarily
right. True. Exactly, yeah. So I'm just pretty much shying away from any kind of an auction right now. Do you notice any difference in going to the in-person auctions or the live auctions?
Not a whole lot. There's people there that get fired up and they bid way above the list pricing.
Mm-hmm.
Also,
yeah, they're also bidding on them online too.
But it's
even the live auction.
To find buyers.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, good.
In fact, the last live auction I went to was a Hudson and Marshall auction in Charlotte, and there was a guy sitting right in front of me. He bid on a one-bedroom condo in Charlotte about, like you said, $10,000 or $20,000 or whatever more than it was worth. And as soon as the bid was over and he won, I tapped him on the shoulder and I said, I have some other properties if you're still interested in more. And because I knew he just paid
yeah.
way too much for it.
I tap him on the shoulder, too.
Exactly.
Mm. Okay.
Well, I hope that helped.
Yeah, it really did. And I noticed in the information that I had on making my call that you wanted us to share one thing that we've learned about, you know, since we've joined the Inner Circle.
Right.
And I just wanted to share that something that has been huge for me, and that is how to increase my productivity. How to stop wasting my time, how to, you know, not go ADD on the internet, how to be really focused. And so I've really cut my productive time. I've really raised the bar on that tremendously, and I'm tracking it. And it's really been a huge help, and it shows.
Awesome.
Last week I made 5 offers, so.
That's great. That's great. Good
yeah.
for you. Good for you. Well, thanks for sharing that. I really appreciate it. So,
hey, Larry, this is Patty
again.
I just want to say something about, you know, since I've joined the Inner Circle, in my past real estate experience, I never did such low bids, and I am amazed at what people come down from.
I love it. That's great.
It's just amazing. It's like, wow.
You don't know if you don't ask, right?
That's right. That's right. So that's been a real eye-opener. And getting, you know, I'm at about 45 to 50% right now, but getting more comfortable all the time.
Well, good. When you start getting too comfortable, start going down more.
Exactly. I will.
That's good. Well, you know, it's like I say, if you're not embarrassed, it's probably too high.
Right.
That's good. Well, good for you. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah.
Hey, Larry, this is Brian. How you doing?
Hey, good. How are you, Brian?
Good. Hey, I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about the negotiating process from the first call to the agreement call, I guess you'd call it. What kind of things are you talking to them about? About how many times are you calling them? How long apart do you wait between those calls where you call them and give them a little bit more money?
Well, are you talking about who's the owner? Is it an individual or is it a realtor that we're dealing with?
Well, for right now, I'll say an individual.
Okay. Well, all individuals are different in the sense that, it's really kind of depends on their sense of urgency and their motivation. And so, we're going to call them up. Hey, I was calling about your house at, 125 Oak Street. I saw you had it listed for sale or whatever. Or you might have called me about a postcard or something. So tell me a little bit about your house. And then I'm going to say, well, it sounds nice. Why are you selling? And then I want to know the story. I want to know the reason because, there's even problem properties or problem people. Either it's in a bad area and they're tired of renting it out or they're tired of living there or something, or something happened. A life-changing event is typically what makes somebody a motivated seller. A divorce, a loss of job, a loss of a loved one, or something like that is what, it's a life-changing event that turns somebody into a motivated seller. So I want to find out what that is. And then I'm going to, well, let me ask you a question. About how much work do you think it needs? Well, I don't know. Well, let me ask you this question. How's the kitchen? When was it last updated? How's the floor there? What about the countertops? When were they last replaced? When was the kitchen last remodeled? What about the carpet? When's the last time you painted? How old is the roof? You're going to go through all that stuff with them.
Sure.
And, based on what you're telling me, a little house like this, I can't really give a whole lot for it. Whether you're dealing with me or any other investor out there, we're going to need to be around the same price as an investor. And it looks like, based on what you're telling me, I know you're asking $80,000, but, a little house like this, I'm probably going to need to be in maybe mid to high 40s. In fact, the last house I bought like this, very similar to yours, I think I was probably around $38,000 or $39,000. Have you had any offers on your house? So what I've just done is I've price conditioned them to the mid to high 40s, and then I dropped the number down even lower to the high 30s, and then I asked them if they've had any offers. And what do you think the answer is going to be to that? Probably no.
Mm-hmm.
So, at that point, I'm going to say, they might say, well, I can't do anything like that. Well, let me ask you a question about how close could you come? And if they say, oh, well, I'm going to need to be in at least around $60,000. Well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to shoot you out. I'm going to go ahead and shoot you out an offer to purchase and give you my business card, and you hang on to it. And if something changes, you give me a call back. And then you can put them down to call them back in a week or two and see. Or if you get their email address, you can follow up with them with autoresponders if you want to.
Okay. Gotcha.
That makes sense?
Yes, yes, it does.
Good. And it just really kind of depends. Sometimes, you said go through the first few calls or whatever. If they say, well, I got to talk to my wife or, I'm supposed to meet with somebody else and I'll let you know how that goes or I'll know how that goes and know if I can take your offer or whatever, then just every deal is kind of different. If you're way far apart, just send them out a written offer to purchase with your business card and put them in an autoresponder to follow up. If they've got equity and they are motivated, you could put down to give them a call every 2 weeks to see where they are. It's just every situation's a little bit different. It's hard to say how many calls you're going to make with each person.
Sure. Now, when it's an REO, do you get that personal or do that much follow-up with them?
If it's a bank-owned property?
Yeah.
No. No, we don't do any kind of an autoresponder or anything for the realtors. But what we do is on the ones that we talk to and make offers on, not the HUD houses or not auction houses, But if we talk to a realtor, it's just a bank-owned property, and we submitted an offer, we will make a note to follow up with them and see if they got a counter next week. Because sometimes we don't even get counters, but our goal is to at least get a counter. And it could be you sent your offer to them and they didn't even submit it to the seller because they already know the seller's not going to take it. You can't make them, but you also don't want to make them mad either by saying, well, I know you're required by law to submit every offer, regardless of how low it is. You know, you don't want to do that. But
yeah.
some people do that, but I wouldn't do it. Yeah. Does that help?
Yeah, it does. It does. That's probably where I've had the most sticking point is with the REO or the realtor for the bank not being very communicative at all, either telling us that they got a counter or whether or not the offer was even presented. I mean, they just give us nothing.
Really? And that happens sometimes. That happens. Sometimes you won't get an offer. That's just
sure.
Or a counter. That's just the
right.
way it is.
All right, thanks.
Sure, no problem. Who's next?
Larry, can you hear me?
Yes.
Daniel, Virginia.
What's up?
Having trouble with time management. Can you maybe touch on that?
Time management?
Yeah, finding enough time to do what I need to do.
Okay.
I work a full-time job.
Okay, so... do you have your money lined up?
Yes.
You do have money lined up. Okay.
I've got
so
some.
If you
I've
have
got
money
some.
Lined up, do you know how to analyze a deal?
Yes.
Good. So the next most important thing would be to make offers, right?
Okay.
So what I would do is I would spend all my time making offers. If you've got, say you've got 1 hour a day, that's all you got. Okay? In your phone, you got a smartphone, right?
Correct.
In your phone, either log in to your realtor.com account or your Zillow.com account, and throughout the day, breaks, lunches, whatever, look for properties that you want to make offers on and call about, okay? And then even during those breaks or during lunch or whatever, you could even shoot over the realtor an email and say, hey, I want to make an offer on this property. And please call me after work, after 5 o'clock. And then after 5 o'clock, your phone's going to start ringing if you do that about 10 times a day. Or you could just bookmark and save, not bookmark, but save properties in your realtor.com account or Zillow.com account. And then after 5 o'clock, you can get on the phone and start calling these realtors and ask them and making offers. And but at least you've got 5 or 10 or 15 a day that you know you're going to be making offers on that day. And you're not going to reach everybody that day, but you might reach one or two and be able to get an offer. And after a while, you're going to start getting some traction and some momentum. And some days... You know, once you've been doing this a couple of weeks, then some days you're going to get realtors calling you back from the previous day. You're going to get counteroffers. You know, you're going to be submitting counteroffers yourself. So you're going to start getting some momentum and have multiple things going on each day. But if you got your money lined up and you know how to analyze a deal, next thing is make offers, make offers, make offers.
And are these verbal offers?
Either one. If you're on the phone with a realtor, then you say, hey, based on what you're telling me, I'd like to put in an offer around $38,000. They're going to say, I need a proof of funds. I need a copy of a bank statement. I need this, blah, 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 blah. You could say, hey, I can get all that for you. That's not a problem. However, most of the realtors that I work with, they have the kind of relationship with their asset manager where they'd rather just shoot them an email or give them a quick call and say, we got an offer in this range. Do you want me to put it on paper? That way, you're not spending a lot of arts and crafts time putting an offer together on something that you know is going to come back as a counter or something that they're not going to accept or they're just going to reject off the bat. And I don't want to waste your time. So do you have that kind of relationship with your asset managers where you can just shoot them an email and ask them if they want you to put it on paper? And that works a lot of the time, not every time, but a lot of the time.
Got it.
Makes sense?
Makes a lot of sense.
Good, good.
Thank you.
Awesome. Good. I hope that helped.
That does.
Great, great. Okay, who's next?
Okay, I'll jump in again.
Okay.
This is Gary again. One of the things I've noticed is that it looks like there's a lot of wasted material on the MLS sites in the form of withdrawn and expired listings.
Withdrawn,
now, you never have a buyer. Yeah. Now, you never have a buyer's name, but you usually get an address and a PIN number. Sometimes you get a PIN number. It's only with an address I can find out who the buyer is and how much they owe on the property and just by using the GIS maps. Have you worked any of those, or any of your people worked those, and have you found them to be at all productive or not?
Now, say that again. So just run through the whole thing again for me.
Okay. On the MLS list that we have, there's two categories called with one's called withdrawn. That means the property's been withdrawn from the and the other one is expired. The expired listings. Well, they're listed with addresses and what the sales price was, and et cetera, but you don't have an owner's name. But I can find I can generally find the owner's name.
Sure.
Once I have a, and I can usually find a PIN number if they don't have the PIN number there. So
sure.
I can usually track that down. Have you done any searches on those and gone after those? Maybe they're just so frustrated because their realtor didn't do a good job for them, but they really would like to sell the house. Or
It could be, but I will tell you this too. If you're talking about primarily properties that are owned by individuals,
mm-hmm.
I probably wouldn't waste my time.
Okay.
I will tell you who does work those. Realtors work those. They're called expired listings, and realtors
mm-hmm.
work those expired listings to try to get a new listing. But
right.
But personally, myself, when I'm searching the internet for properties, when I see furniture in a house, I just move on to the next one.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Now, if I was in a market where there was a lot of competition and there was a lot of other. There wasn't as many foreclosed homes, and I had to fight for every deal, I might look at those. But
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of foreclosures out there, especially on the lower-priced houses. Most of them don't have furniture in them, so I know they're bank-owned or HUD-owned
mm-hmm.
or VA-owned
right.
or, whatever. But if a house has furniture, typically I'm just going to move on. I'm not even going to call about it or inquire about
yeah.
it.
Yeah, and trash doesn't count, right?
Yeah, if they're living there, I move on.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Yeah.
Larry, it's Dave McGee again.
Hey.
I've got a question. So if we're looking at properties that have been repossessed, and what's an ideal time to start calling on them? Is it 1 week, 2 weeks, 1 month, 2 months that they've been listed?
You say it's been repossessed. You mean it's a foreclosure?
Yeah, it's an REO.
And it's listed on the MLS.
Well, yes, listed on the MLS, right.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Well,
We have an REO that has started to send me some properties, to consider.
Right, right.
And they're the largest in the state of Virginia. So, but I just wonder, when's the ideal time? Is it best to wait 30 days? Is it best to wait 45 days? Is it best to wait a week or 2 weeks or what?
Well, I'm going to answer it this way, okay? It depends, and I know that's the lawyer answer, but I'm going to tell you why it depends. Okay, we bought a house, and I think I told you guys about this house, that I paid 103% of list, and it had been on the market for, we bid on it on the 16th day because it was the very first day it was available to investors. So really, if you want to look at it like this, it was on the market one day for investors, and we bid on it, and we paid over list, because all the comps were coming in around 100 or more, 90 to 120, and it was listed for 44, and we paid 45.6 for it. So, 601 actually. But anyway, we paid more for it because we knew it was worth a lot more, and it was underpriced. So we did that because we already knew the value, we knew it was a good deal, and we could make money on it. Now, having said that, if there's a property that is listed for $44,000 and I know I need to be paying $20,000 to $25,000, I can tell you they're not going to come down that low for until probably around the 60th or 70th day on market, somewhere around there. Somewhere between 60 and 90 days, they're going to start thinking about accepting a bid. And chances are if it's listed for 40, let's say it's listed for $44,000, they're probably going to do a price drop down to $39,900, and then maybe $34,900, then maybe $29,900, and then that's when you'll be able to pick it up for in the low to mid-20s.
If you saw one that's less than a month on the market, should you offer them maybe 90% of what they're asking?
Well, what you should offer them does not depend on what they're asking. What you should offer them depends on how much you can pay based on the numbers you ran.
Right.
So if your numbers say you can offer them 90%, then go ahead and put it down. I mean, if, especially if you're talking about HUD, it's a computer anyway. Just go ahead and leave the bid out
there. Scenario.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, it really depends on what you can pay. And then you could just talk to the realtor if it's just a listed property, if it's an REO, just talk to the realtor and find out, you know, hey, based on what you're telling me, you know, I'm going to need to be probably around 80 or 90% of list price on this one. You know, do you think there's any point in submitting an offer?
Okay. Gotcha. All
That's
right.
the way I would play that.
Mm-hmm.
That helps.
Yeah, it sure does.
Good, good. Who's next?
Well, I have a question.
Sure.
Once again, it's back to Carolina Choice Mortgage. So my understanding is that when you go to sell the note, unless you have an awesome buyer's list of note buyers, it one of the criteria for selling the note is going to be the loan servicing that's associated with that.
That does help. We found out that the process is simpler if we already have servicing in place to just sell that note and the servicing does not skip a beat.
So have you found that it makes any difference who the servicer is?
It makes any difference to who?
To the buyers. Do the buyers care who the loan servicing is coming from?
The ones I'm selling to don't. No, I mean really. I'm not selling. I'm typically not selling to institutions.
Yeah.
Some institutions want to either bring servicing in house and service themselves, or they want to move the servicing to somebody else that they normally use in servicing notes. And I would just rather deal with an individual that has a self-directed retirement account and just wants to get passive income, and then they're okay with the servicing that I have in place. That's the people I like to sell notes to.
Well, that's awesome. Okay.
Yeah, good. That help, Meg?
I'll talk with you separately on that. I'm in an interesting position now. I took your training and joined the Inner Circle about 3.5 months ago, and I now have 5 notes seasoning to get ready to sell, and I haven't sold any notes yet. So I'm either doing great or I'm in trouble.
That's okay. Don't worry about that. No, you're in good shape. If you qualified your people, you got servicing in place, you're in good shape, and once you get ready to sell those notes, that's fine. If you're seizing them, you could probably sell them to an institution, and you might be able to get more money, but you might also be able to sell them to just somebody that has a self-directed retirement account. And in the circles you work in, you know people who have money. you ought to be able to sell those notes pretty quick.
Well, I hope that'll be true.
Awesome. You can do it. And let me know if I can help you with anything.
I absolutely will be calling on you.
But you are setting the woods on fire, girl. You're doing it.
I'm having a great time.
That's awesome. You're making it happen. You've been churning and burning since you left the office.
That was the goal, yes.
That's great. Well, I'm so happy for you. I really am. And you're right here in my backyard. You're taking my deals.
I know that I am listing in all the same places that you're listing in. I keep seeing your ads, like, all over the place.
Do you really?
Yeah, really. Your ads and your signs are, like, all over my market. But that's fine, because it's a big market. There's room for both of us.
What do you mean, all over your market? You're all over my market. I'm just kidding. I'm really happy for you. I really am.
Thank you. It's working great.
That's good. I'm glad to hear it. Who's next? You guys have had some really good questions tonight. Really good stuff. And you know what the cool thing is? A lot of you guys out there working the deals, got deals going on, you're making money, you're closing deals. That's sweet. I'm excited for you. That's awesome. Anybody else have a question? Looks like I've answered all the questions. Going once.
Okay, I'm jumping in again.
Go ahead.
I feel like I'm hogging it all. I just got my Inner Circle thumb drive in the mail this weekend.
Good.
Along with my bell. And, which I'm very excited to use and hope to use it tomorrow. of course, I'll ring it when I make an offer from now on, too.
There you go. That's good.
Yeah. Well, it's all part of the process. I guess, let's see. Now that I've got the, I wish I would have had the thumb drive when Nathan was here in my home visit.
Right.
But I didn't. And so I've gone through and I've started personalizing some of the documents. For instance, the assessment or the assignment document, you know, moving it from Investors Rehab to my LLC and all those things, and putting it in forms that I can use and stuff like that, and I'll continue doing that. But what's the best way for me to approach that? Because it seems like a lot of the stuff in there also applies to some of your other programs, like your HUD programs and other things.
Hey, let me tell you what's on the flash drive, okay?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
It's basically every real estate-related computer document or digital document that I have on my computer.
Mm-hmm.
There's anything from a lease option, assignments, mortgage, deed of trust, loan modification agreement, hard money lending documents, private placement memorandum, options, everything that I have that's real estate related on my computer. And that's what it is. So I wouldn't say that you need to necessarily go through everything and you're going to use it. Just be familiar with what's on there, because
mm-hmm.
that's stuff that has taken me years to accumulate.
I'm sure,
And it's just stuff that I have on my personal computer. And some of them I had created, some of them I got other places as well. So that's exactly what it is.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
It's like waking up at Christmas.
I hear. You know what? I used to, back before we had flash drives, or back before they were popular, this was probably, I don't know, 7-8 years ago, I would put all those documents on a CD.
Oh, jeez.
And I would record them on the CD while people were at my office, and I would write Larry's personal real estate forms, and I would put value, $10,000 on it. Because I know I've paid more than that to get all those forms and documents through, you know, paying attorneys and other home study courses and different places that I've gotten those documents from. So So, I would tell people, this is what you really came for right here. This is everything. That's funny. Anybody else have a question?
Yeah, Larry, I got one other question. Can you hear
okay.
me? Yeah, having some tax issues, would you know a good CPA attorney, that type thing?
I do. Are you just interested in tax planning or tax strategies, or are you concerned about it, or do you have an audit you're going through?
Not an audit, but need to get some back taxes paid.
You need to get some back taxes paid.
Yeah, I'll get them done and paid.
Okay. Let me think about that. Shoot me an email, and I'll make a couple recommendations.
Okay, sounds good. Larry at Larry Goins?
Yeah. In fact, let me just do this. Here, write this down, okay?
Okay.
Let me get a pen and paper right now. These are my guys right here.
Okay, go ahead.
Ki Shin, K-I is the first name. Shin, S-H-I-N is the second last name. And
uh-huh.
Their number is 864-322-8995. And you tell him that I told you to call. Now, I don't get a referral or anything like that. I'm just saying that he'll know you're one of my students.
Right.
And he'll know you. He'll know you're one of my students, and you just say, I was asking Larry last night, I've had some tax problems, and I asked him who to call, and he said to call you.
Sounds good.
Awesome. Awesome. Good luck with that.
Thank you.
Sure, no problem. Anybody else have a question? Anybody else? All right, going once. Going twice. Good call tonight, guys. A little over an hour. You guys had a lot of questions. That's awesome. Just know that you can call me or email me anytime in between these biweekly Q&A calls. I answered probably 4 or 5 emails today from Inner Circle students. So just know that you can do that. Always put Inner Circle in the subject line. My email is larry@larrygoins.com. Or you can call the office, 803-831-0056. Press 0, and whoever answers, tell them that you are an Inner Circle student and ask for me, okay? So with that, thank you guys very much for being on here. I really appreciate it. Great questions, great group tonight. You guys are very active. Keep the testimonials coming. I love to hear it. Shoot me a video and send me a testimonial, and I'll put it out on the website. Thanks a lot, guys. Have a great night. Bye-bye, everybody.
Thanks, Larry.
See you.
Thanks,
thank you, guys. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.